I'd just like to say what a privilege it is to be speaking in this panel. I'm going to be a little more academic than the wonderful practitioners we've just been hearing, but I hope that what I'm going to say will reflect in its own way on the kinds of issues they've been addressing. In a 1959 lecture at New York's Museum of Primitive Art, the anthropologist Robert Redfield provided a succinct and compelling account of art and artifact, the two installation paradigms developed under modernism for the viewing of African and other non-Western objects. He began by establishing their dialectical structural relationship. The art installation promotes appreciation of the object's immanent meanings and aesthetic experience, while the ethnographic or artifact display references the transcendent meanings and involves cognitive experience. In the best liberal and humanistic tradition of the day, Redfield argued further that the two kinds of experience are not oppositional, but constitute rather parallel paths to knowledge of the other. The modernist ideal of universality is captured in his concluding statement, quote, "Whether we come to see the artifact as a creative mastery of form, or see it as a sign or symbol of a traditional way of life, we are discovering for ourselves new territory of our common humanity," unquote. How much has changed since 1959? The furious debates sparked by the Museum of Modern Art's 1984 show, Primitivism in 20th Century Art, revealed the erosion of the art and artifact paradigms wrought by the workings of post-structuralism, at least on a theoretical level. Now, almost 20 years later, the reinstallation of permanent African exhibits in a number of museums offers an opportunity to assess the impact of theoretical reflexivity, post-colonial critiques, and revisionist history on modernist museum practices. Just like the first two slides. I just did. Do I have to point them in order for it to, do I have to aim them at that? No? Okay. Thank you. In this paper, I will look at three of these exhibits, African Worlds at London's Horniman Museum and African Voices at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, both of which opened in 1999, and the British Museum's Sainsbury African Galleries. Nope, sorry. Which opened in 2000. The larger question that informs this discussion is the degree to which the continuities and discontinuities with central modernist tropes of time, space, and the autonomous object indicate a shift towards museum practices that hold the promise of becoming transnational and postcolonial. To varying degrees, the installations that the new exhibitions replace represented Africa as distant from and prior to the space and time of Western modernity. I just have to press a bit harder. In both the Horniman's earlier Universal Survey Exhibition of World Ethnology and the Smithsonian's 1960s Hall of African Peoples, the geographical space of Africa was confined largely to sub-Saharan regions and disproportionately to West and Central Africa, while the time of Africa was the fictive ethnographic present. As numerous analyses have demonstrated, these representational conventions inscribe essentialized notions of race and implicitly deny the modernity of Africa and the authenticity of diasporic African cultures. The immediate predecessors to the Sainsbury Galleries were a series of rotating, temporary, special topic exhibits staged at the British Museum's off-site ethnographic branch, the Museum of Mankind. While these exhibits contextualized objects more fully than had the main building's typological displays, overall they continued to represent Africa as a set of distanced, localized cultures. Few would have predicted the dramatic change in installation approach that has occurred in the new Sainsbury Galleries. Funded by a gift from renowned collectors Robert and Lisa Sainsbury, they are dedicated to Henry Moore. A lengthy text panel just outside the entrance includes Sir Robert's statement that, quote, "What I am is someone who liked artists who liked primitive and were influenced by primitive. I liked Henry Moore's carving. Henry Moore liked primitive," unquote. Although the anonymous curatorial voice hastily intervenes to explain that, quote, "primitive in this context is shorthand. As Moore himself remarked, primitive is misleading if it is taken to imply crudeness or incompetence," unquote, the notion of the primitive imprints itself through its multiple repetitions and frames the value of the African objects on exhibition in terms of the, quote, "wealth of experience and inspiration," unquote, they have provided for modern Western artists. I don't know what I'm doing here, but they are not advancing, maybe this way. The introductory space on the left presents large and dramatic examples of contemporary African art by artists from Egypt and North, South, East, and West Africa. Their prominence strongly signals the exhibition's acceptance both of the revisionist whole Africa approach and of the authenticity of contemporary modernist African art. The objects displayed in the four large rooms that lead off this space are grouped into seven categories based on media, technology, and function: wood carving, pottery, forged metal, mask. The Mende Sande Society mask in the bottom center, the second genre I will use to sample each of the exhibits discussed in this essay, tests this proposition. It is displayed in the masquerade section amidst numerous other examples of canonical mask genres. The overall curatorial intent is to provide a level of ethnographic context within the aesthetic envelope and to amplify basic information through strategic juxtapositions with videos, striking installations, and contemporary works. In the present case, while proximity to the Sokari Douglas Camp figure of a Calabari masquerader might possibly, quote, "lead the visitor to question what a mask might be," unquote, it cannot provide understandings culturally specific to the Mende. The brief text ignores a substantial body of recent feminist scholarship on Sande. Its use of the ethnographic present, for example, the Mende have one of the few African masking traditions where masks are actually worn and performed by women as events of the Sande society, unquote, is particularly problematic given the horrific violence Mende people were suffering in Sierra Leone, even as the label was being written. The underlying art installation paradigm is also curiously at odds with the unexceptional quality of the example chosen from the British Museum's fine collection of Mende masks, and with the difficulty of seeing individual pieces clearly. As elsewhere in the Sainsbury galleries, the elegance of the design recalls the glossy displays of a superior department store, privileging the impression of quantity and variety over both ethnographic specificity and aesthetic singularity. The Horniman Museum's African Worlds is also an object-centered exhibit that borrows aspects of its installation approach from the Art Museum. Like the Sainsbury Galleries, too, it introduced a radical shift in design. However, while the British Museum's curators had to fit into a predetermined institutional style, Anthony Shelton, who was then the Horniman's chief curator, worked with hand-picked designer Michael Cameron to create a new visual language. This takes the form of a modernist installation designed to sit uneasily within the classical vaulted space of the gallery. The materials are aggressively industrial, and the cases incorporate asymmetrical, cubist, jarring, and disruptive elements. It was considered essential, Shelton has written, to convey a sense of alienation in the gallery, alienation in the sense that these objects were displaced, far removed from the conditions of their usage and original signification. Shelton's curatorial approach also presents a sharp contrast to that of the British Museum team. Inspired by recent collaborative models developed by North American museums working with indigenous peoples, he created a curatorial committee of African and British professionals. They identified 8 themes that reflect both European and African social, political, and conceptual categories, such as patronage, ancestors and morality, text image history, parody and humor. In parallel, Shelton initiated the African Voices Project to collect interpretive statements from people of African and Caribbean descent living in London. These are given pride of place on the object labels, even though some criticize or express sadness about museum treatment and ownership of African objects. The post-colonial historical sensibility and post-structuralist multivocality of African worlds is evident in its approach to the display of Benin brasses. These are installed in cases that suggest wall safes, designed to maintain clear visibility while conveying simultaneously both the object's value and ambivalence about their presence in Britain. The main text panel gives a detailed history of the Kingdom of Benin and explicitly problematizes the issue of ownership. It highlights the 2 prominent Nigerian co-curators who developed the historical interpretation and states that they have appealed, quote, to the conscience of the world for a meaningful dialogue for a peaceful resolution of this shame of history, unquote. A local diasporic reality informs the Horniman's presentation of its Mende masks. They are interpreted by Mrs. Beatrice Woozy, a Mende wife and community worker living in London. Quote, it's supposed to be a mythical being that comes and teaches the children, the initiates, how to behave, how to sit properly. She teaches them how to dance. You see how they do her hair, her neck. Everything that we consider beauty, it's in there. It's something that personifies excellence. You can see the culture in it. It's the leader, it's the mistress, it's what the mask is. Mrs. Woozy's statement breaks down the exoticism of African female initiation through its presentation of the mask as the embodiment of an aesthetic and moral ideal, and of Sunday as a living institution invested with important social responsibility. Because the expert speaking voice belongs to a woman living in London, the label conveys contemporaneity and proximity, collapsing the distance between Europe and Africa. The Smithsonian's decision to reinstall its African exhibits was directly stimulated by complaints from Africans and African Americans about racist and offensive aspects of the old 1960s displays. The curators thus had a clear mandate to respond to contemporary critiques and new historical constructs of Africa and the diaspora. As at the Horniman exhibit, the curators collaborated closely with Africans both in Africa and in Washington. The exhibition is organized along a central historical timeline, off of which open sections that address contemporary African life and cultures. These are grouped under 3 broad themes: living in Africa, working in Africa, and wealth in Africa, each interpreted by means of large photo murals, interactive modules, and objects. The curators desire to increase understanding of the continent's modernity and its contemporary relevance is manifested in the fact that nearly 70% of the objects they chose or acquired specially for the new exhibit were made after 1960. After testing their exhibition design on typical Washington visitors, the curators abandoned an initial poetic relationship of text and object for a more unambiguous and didactic approach, rejecting, that is, the kind of reliance on the visitor's ability to infer meaning that is characteristic of art galleries and that was adopted to differing degrees by the 2 London museums. The Benin display, which is part of the Living in Africa section, exemplifies the exhibition's overall privileging of history, the contemporary, and the voices of Africans. The main case features a poster created by the Benin authorities for the centenary of the punitive expedition, giving a detailed history alongside a statement from the current Oba honoring all our gallant heroes who fell during the British invasion. The poster thus voices Benin historical memory and becomes the main object in the case, while the historical brass, which is in the case with it, becomes a secondary illustrative adjunct. The Mende mask in African Voices is subordinated to a thematic message about current cultural values. It appears in the Wealth in Africa section, where it is juxtaposed with an eclectic assemblage of contemporary objects, such as an Ethiopian graduation robe and diploma, that challenge Western understandings of wealth with the notion that in Africa, quote, wealth takes various forms, money, knowledge, and connections between people. The mask's ritual context and its iconographic meanings are explained in the object label, but the visual experience of it as sculpture is diminished by bad lighting and the visual noise of all the didactic materials. As at the British Museum, the war, anarchy, and tragedy experienced by the Mende during the 1990s are not mentioned, and the installation projects a sense of bustling contemporary vitality. This was a conscious decision on the part of the curators, who wanted African Voices to counter, quote, media coverage that tends to emphasize Africa's problems. Despite their differences, all three shows represent the time and space of Africa and the West as coextensive and interpenetrating. As Holland Cotter put it in a recent New York Times review of an exhibition of contemporary African art, quote, Africa, whatever it is everywhere. It's far more than just a continent. It's a global diaspora, an international culture, and a metaphor with fantastical associations for the West, gold, savages, darkest, deepest, liberation, devastation, unquote. In 1959, in contrast, Redfield had justified the West's appropriation of African objects into the museum on the basis of a standard structural dichotomy between tradition and modernity. African societies were bounded and local, whereas Western ones were cosmopolitan and mobile. It is here in the West, he had said, that some people have gone farthest in developing an interest in and appreciation of art derived from some knowledge of the arts of many traditions, unquote. This comparison has also revealed the continuing deployment of art and artifact, which seem, if anything, to have gained in rhetorical strength. They are mixed and matched with remarkable freedom in museums of different kinds. Why, after decades of post-structuralist and post-colonial critique, do these object-centered and objectifying strategies continue to retain their holds on us? The answer has to do, I think, with the nature of the museum as a physical and spatial environment, purpose-built to be a container for objects. Museums exist to fulfill a profound desire, deeply rooted in Western cultures, for experiences of wonder and resonance, as Stephen Greenblatt has put it. What has happened in at least two of the recent exhibits is not the rejection of this basic proposition, but rather a loosening of fixed relationships between certain signifiers and signifieds that had been generated by modernist ideologies. But the ruptures with modernism are uneven. At the British Museum, ocular centrism triumphs while the space of Africa expands. At the Horniman and the Smithsonian, historical revisionism has gone much further, and modernist tropes of the primitive and constructs of authenticity are more thoroughly interrogated. As multivocal curatorial processes do their work, African objects are being tied to new and different meanings attributed to them by people who have long lived within Western nations, or who are now more closely connected through travel, media, and capital flows, but whose understandings of these objects have not before been reflected by the museums that own them. Under colonialism, and even more after, the West has been exporting museums and their technologies of representation as integral parts of modernity's archiving, memorializing, and nation-building practices. These three exhibits also demonstrate how successfully museological conventions have been translated, so that now, in the era of globalization, museum savvy can be re-imported to the mother countries through collaborative curatorial processes. As illustrated by both African Worlds and African Voices, these processes typically engage Western-trained African museum professionals together with non-professional community members who are mentored into the conventions of Western museological practice, and who often come to constitute, in after years, a cadre of regular museum collaborators adept at manipulating its conventions and characteristic technologies. Just as modernist ceramics by Magdaleno Dundo, sculptures of masquerade figures by Sokari Douglas Camp, or Somali and Egyptian ethnographic artifacts have become part of the new revised museum canon of African art and artifact, so has collaborative curation become the new museum practice that expresses contemporary pluralist ideology. As Arjuna Padurai has argued, globalization is modernity at large. We can add museum technologies to his list of global flows. Nanette Solomon spoke this morning of the illegibility produced by revisionist processes when they're overlaid on old museum conventions. It should by now be no secret that I think that the Horniman has thus far achieved the most successful integration of art, artifact, and new theoretical perspectives. The point is that we need to continue to work critically with museums to ensure that they continue to work to get beyond modernism. And although I began to know Judith Mastai only in the last few years and very much regret that just as she had moved back to Vancouver, her life came to an end. But I think that it's in this spirit that she would have wanted us to continue working. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ruth. Now.